We are fortunate today to be joined by Mr. Ben Sawyer of Digital Mill, who will be speak to us about recent advances in the gaming area. Ben is a leader in the serious games community. Now, originating from Southern Maine, the University of Southern Maine in Portland, Mr. Sawyer's presentation is entitled "What We Know About Games in the Classroom." Ben.
Hi. Everybody can hear me fine. I'm still getting used to the whole video conferencing thing. Just to introduce myself, my name's Ben Sawyer. I run a project called the Serious Games Initiative, and also run a project called the Games for Health Project, which was spun out of the Serious Games Initiative and is funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in Princeton, New Jersey. So we have a great deal of affinity for New Jersey here. What we also do in my firm is we work on with companies and organizations to explore what the game space can offer them, both for learning and for some other areas. And my actual introduction into the idea of using games for something other than entertainment was a project here, which I'll flip to real quick and show a screenshot of. This is a screenshot from a game I worked on called Virtual U, which is basically SimCity for university managers, which was funded by the Sloan Foundation. I attended university for quite some time, but left early. So pretty much everything I've learned about being an academic, I've learned from this game, in both producing and playing it. And if anybody wants a copy of it, you can download it for free at virtual-u.org. And this was funded by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Just going to transfer into my presentation. The presentation that I sent is just titled The Serious Games Landscape. I'm going to talk about learning in games in the classroom, but in order to do that, I'm going to race through a bunch of slides that just give you some background into what we're talking about when we're talking about games and the serious game space. And going to the first slide, there's some resources here that I have on the web that you can also download, including a trailer, our websites for the various projects, as well as our a nominal Games for Health PowerPoint stack, and then a recent presentation that I've been doing around the country called Serious Gamers, which talks about all the kind of interesting things game players are doing with games besides just playing them. And there's a lot of really interesting sort of anecdotes in that, of all kinds of just fantastic things that people are doing with games in a number of different disciplines. Going on to slide three, I always make the point that even though we're called the Serious Games Initiative, that we take all games seriously and that all games are serious. What we talk about with serious games is the idea that it's gaming moving beyond entertainment. But we would be remiss if we didn't think as humans that entertainment is an important part of being human and of our lives. And our point, though, is that in terms of games and entertainment, this is a solved problem. And if you don't think games have solved entertainment, I just say talk to a television executive and ask them where their audience is going. So moving on to slide four. Just some quick quotes. These are two fairly well-known writers. One is a PC technology writer named John Dvorak, and I would suspect that most people have heard of Tom Clancy. And John Dvorak, who's been watching PCs for 30, 40 years, has this well-worn quote on my end, which says that real progress in desktop computing always stems from gaming. And Tom Clancy has a character in one of his latest books that remarks when the NSA hasn't found enough great programmers, that the smartest programmers don't work for Uncle Sam anymore. They develop video games. And Tom Clancy should know something about that since he's employed a number of very smart programmers at a company he helped found called Red Storm Entertainment. Going on to slide five, the serious games opportunity is really about taking a 30-year pool of talent and technology into other problem spaces that can benefit from cutting-edge technologies and design practices that have proven in entertainment with key demographics and in this what I call very Darwinian industry of the games business. You're only as good as your last hit product. CEOs can lose out in less than a year their position if shareholders aren't happy with the performance of games. If your games don't perform as well as the last bit, your sales will tumble. A game might not last on the shelf for more than 4 weeks if it doesn't start showing sales. So if that's not a high-pressure environment to force people to be interested in your product, to design something that's compelling, to make it easy to use and easy to enjoy, and to put, as I heard somebody say, somebody on a time on task, I would say I don't know of a tougher environment in some ways. The potential creative ways to solve existing and new problems with agreed upon comparative advantages that games and game developers, I'm always trying to underline the talent that's also behind this, and the technologies readily supply. And we're still learning what those comparative advantages may or may not be, but as we start to have some consensus on it, both through empirical research and observation, we're trying to hone those. And then it's really about the creation or recreation of a new field of game development with revenues that are already in the millions. Recreation meaning we did at one point in the game industry had sort of a rich edutainment sector, mostly focused on sort of K through 8th grade. It actually got destroyed in a number of market upheavals, not the least which because most of the games actually weren't that great. They were being sold quite readily to parents that were trying to embrace computers and anything that they could get their kids to use. But
there's no way to...
Hello? Is everybody still hearing me? Okay. It's in terms of that, what we're trying to do is move beyond that, take all that we've learned, especially in the last 15 years, and reapply it to a whole new generation, to widen it, to get more age ranges, more demographic, more regions involved in this, and really sort of expanding the content range, moving up into higher level subjects. And I think it's also about changing the nature of e-learning and making it much more about the power of computers versus the power of a new transmission method. I think a lot of what was involved in early CBT and e-learning was about transferring a style of content, almost like lecturing online or transferring text online or text and pictures, into a new transmission method, gaining some comparative advantage of that, distance learning, asynchronous learning, better ability to kind of move around in some level of nonlinear capability, some tracking and some other things. But it really wasn't using all of the computing power that we've developed probably since 2000. I would argue that most traditional e-learning doesn't need a computer built after 2000 or 2002. If you extrapolate Moore's law, you're talking about a 3 to 6 times fold in computing power since then. And really, what's taking advantage of that? Well, when you talk to game developers, they never have enough power on the desktop. We can always find new and exciting ways to use that computational and graphics horsepower better. And I think that gaming, in terms of how we fold it into e-learning, is trying to answer what we do with that increase in computing power that is going to be relentless for at least another decade, if not longer. And what do we do with that? So moving on to slide 6, what's going on? Well, the serious games sort of field is kind of trying to take advantage of these different areas, this potential, and it's growing from what was a grassroots movement 5-6 years ago into what is now a branded movement. You can say serious games in a number of different fields and to a number of different people, and they sort of kind of have a concept of what we mean by that. The growth over the last 3 years has been almost 100% per year, and we use this by tracking visits to our websites, people showing up to our meetings, amount of incoming email that we're getting from people who are looking for contacts or projects off the ground, as well as talking to various bellwether developers and seeing where their revenues are going. 3 years back, this is a little bit old, 4 or 5 years back, our meetings were 30 to 50 people. Now we're regularly pulling in 300 to 700 people and more. And more people are plugging in. We're seeing regional committees set up all around the world. We have a very active community in Japan that we help orchestrate. We have a number of different countries in Europe who are setting up their own specific serious game consortiums. We have a number of different disciplines, such as I mentioned healthcare before. We're looking at science, mobile, and other like corporate training and other areas that we can set up even distinct groups that are meeting. But overall, the field's still experimental and emergent. This is very much wide open space with a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of people just trying to do anything they can to kind of poke at this and get deeper. Going on to slide 7, funding is increasing, but the market's still not huge. I'm saying around 70 million worldwide. It might be well over 100. What we're trying to figure out on the initiative is not just the size of the market, but how much of that is actually going into development. That's the number that we actually care about. Yet, sure, we care about sales because that will spur development, but a large portion of the market is very much a direct purchase market. A company might purchase a specific amount of training, invest in that. A foundation might make an investment. We have a few serious games that are sort of retail-oriented where you're starting to get multiplier of sales into individuals and define market starting. But right now, when the market is as small as it is, we really care about the number growing and getting into the hundreds of millions, being at the developmental and even research level. The field's definitely diversifying and growing the critical segments of education, military, first responders, corporate training, health, science. Avergaming is an entire field unto itself in the serious game space, and I mentioned internationalizing. On to field 8, I just want to talk a little bit about what the community is. It's very much the serious game space is a community-driven enterprise at the moment. We have a listserv at seriousgames.org that you can join. A lot of this has been grassroots organizing that we've done both at the Woodrow Wilson International Center, who's our partner, a number of different universities, a number of different game development groups working with us to set up things like Games for Health, Games for Change, and the Serious Games Initiative. And then we're pulling people in. We're getting press about this different idea where that then brings in emails to our office, to peer groups, and then we're trying to foster peer-to-peer community so that people can collaborate on research grants, so that grant makers can come into the community and find the resources they need to feel comfortable about making a grant. Where we're going next is we're actually going to start setting up much more formal frameworks with specific entities and specific ambassadors, both by region and by subject matter, to foster even deeper peer-to-peer social networking growth. There are a number of different research venues that have started up across both the university space in North America as well as in Europe and in Asia. What's interesting about many of these as I visit them is that they may originate at either the School of Education or the Computer Science program, but the faculty that I find are being very clued in on this are putting together cross-discipline teams. No matter where it's birthed from, the opportunity here is to take a medium and apply it across a number of different subject matter areas. So we're seeing things like universities setting up partnerships with their med schools, partnerships with their schools of education, with their computer science schools, building cross-degree programs. So, for instance, USC requires people to take various courses in the film school, in the School of Education, so that as they're developing these new types of game developers, they're not just pumping out a person who can do code or make art. And it's also important to note that what we're talking about in terms of growing a field, especially in terms of learning, that we are seeing programs start up both with research orientation as well as engineering orient, and combining those two. It's not just enough to research stuff. We really need more people building and experimenting in code with what we can and can't do. Going on to the next slide, it's just searching for a definition. I think it's important to, in these talks, to further define what serious games are. I look at it as the fact that solving problems is what we do as humans. That's why we have gotten as far as we've gotten. We've certainly created a few more that we have to solve, but that's what we spend most of our day-to-day life doing. Entertainment, as I said before, is a solved problem in some ways. I don't think we can always find better ways to entertain ourselves, but boy, we've gotten really good at it. But there are other problems, like teaching, like figuring out the right policies to implement, putting robots on Mars, Venus, and Mercury, overthrowing dictators, and responding to threats. And these are all actually problems that we're applying games to, both very specifically in some cases. And the fact is that problem solving is a great big business, and the game industry is still focused mostly on solving entertainment problems, and we're trying to work very hard with them to establish other problem areas that they can derive revenues from, because what we want is that transfer of the same talent, tools, and technologies, joining in with upstart grassroots initiatives in education research and in other disciplines to give us next-generation applications. Games are solutions. Play has been used since the dawn of mankind. I'm on slide 11 if you're keeping up. Playing is problem solving. Sometimes when I'm talking about serious games, it's kind of funny when people are sort of looking kind of, I'm not so sure about this. And I'm like, well, since when did play, you know, get thrown out of the methodology by which human education works? You know, at times we've been very deliberate in what and why we play. Chess, checkers, and Go, these were not games just for entertainment. Chess was it was a game for teaching strategic thinking among leaders and military leaders. The Olympics was not, you know, invented to sell Coca-Cola. It was invented to find and hone the best athletes and warriors in ancient Greece. And war games aren't called war games because they're fun. And we don't do role-playing at work and in other venues. We don't call it role something other learning. We call it role-playing. And we use simulations, and we've been using them for quite some time. And we also use game theory as a means of labeling a sort of style of economics and decision making that helps us to model and think and decide how we're going to take action on something. So why not computer games and what they represent and how they relate to all of this rich history of learning and problem solving through forms of play, competition, and game design? So moving on to slide 12. So what are serious games? You know, the most simplest way I describe it is serious games are simply solutions to problems, at least we hope, right? Sometimes they're not. They fail. But sometimes they succeed. And what I hone it more to is that serious games is a meaningful use of computerized game and game industry resources whose chief mission is not entertainment. And I underline computerized because we've had games for quite some time, but it wasn't until we created a computer that we could get a very, very rich form of game design, especially single-player gaming. Before computers came around, you really couldn't do rich single-player gaming, and that really has changed the notion of what game playing can be. And it's what allowed us to get to where we are so far with gaming. So what are serious games on slide 13? Again, just simply solutions to problems that utilize assets developed by the modern-day computer and video game industry. The serious in serious games refers to the purpose and nothing else. I have to explain this because I often have people coming up thinking it refers to the content in the game. And I can show you a number of very silly games with very serious messaging purposes that have been developed to improve that. Ironically, it's usually the game developers who come up thinking that. I think they just worry that we're going to take all the fun out of their life, but that's not by any means what we're talking about. But I think the third point that I'm also very want to focus on is that serious game projects do not necessarily result in the creation of a game. There are many different types of things that we can use games for. Let me just finish with this definition. Must solve a problem other than entertainment. Must tie into game development in a number of different ways that I have on slide 14 that I'll skip. And that we also talk about commercial off-the-shelf COTS titles that may have originally been a game that we now use in non-entertainment settings. But as so long as what we're talking about in that regard, we're trying to move beyond the traditional drill and skill edutainment titles that we'd seen in the early 80s. We'd like to kind of disassociate somewhat with those and start to move into higher end ideas. These are on slide 15 is just a little bit about some of the work that my firm's done. I'll just skip over that. On slide 16, I'm just reemphasizing, this is a graph just showing the from history, the very deliberate styles of game designs that we've seen that have had some level of serious purpose in terms of why they were created or what they could also be used for. And I just make the point that SimCity, which is a game that's over 15 years old, is but a blip on that graph, just to give us a sense from human history how recent this real, more specific use of computer games for something other than entertainment really is. What can we do with games besides use them to entertain? Again, I made the point that it's not always games. We've had game projects designed to rethink interfaces to types of vehicles and software and problems and information systems. We've done games that are looking at collective intelligence, where by playing the game, we're able to monitor the types of decisions that a community might make, and from that derive some collective intelligence or instill collective intelligence into a community as they work together to solve a problem and then gain the skills and the teamwork as a resultant of trying to solve that problem in a game-styled setting. We've done data visualization in gaming, using game engines to project data in new ways. We've done content production. There's a whole subgenre called machinima, which is the use of game engines to create real-time 3D movies. And in fact, Steven Spielberg has used machinima tools for pre-visualization for his movie making. We've used games for communications. There are actually lower cost video conferencing systems available for home consoles. We've looked at that in terms of creating new doctor-patient networks. Soldiers in Iraq also play games with their kids at home to have a sort of more meaningful experience than just a phone call, hi, how are you? Now you can actually have kids playing with their parents while they're away, creating a tighter bond. Therapeutic tools. We have a whole section of gaming that's looking at ways where games can instantiate exercise, physical therapy, cognitive exercise, and other types of therapeutic processes, not just learning. There's a whole area of gaming and computer science educators who are looking at gaming as ways to teach and recruit students, especially women, into computer science fields. We are also have a number of just different things that we've done to improve generic software engineering. There are problems that we have to solve in gaming that we have more of an impetus to solve than, say, other areas that would also like to see those problems solved. They're just not as high on their priority list. And we've seen even cultural outreach done through gaming. So I have on slide 18 some uncommon examples. I won't run through all of these, but again, this is just to, while we're going to be talking about learning, I really wanted to use this opportunity to show that we can really stretch this notion of what serious games are. And once you do that, you can actually start to see even new applications even within your own institutions, not just for replacing a lecture or creating a new style of homework. But why use a game at all? Games are growing as a media form. There's little doubt that people are increasingly allocating time away from other media for games. That's why a lot of people are interested in what we could do with gaming. Games may offer better forms of educational experiences, and I preface that by saying at times. There are a number of advocates who might have created the impression that this is just, you know, swap one thing out, put the game in, and hallelujah. We are not kidding ourselves. That's not the case. But we are starting to see research, both observational and empirical, that show us maybe right where games might have advantages over other types of educational media, over other types of technological education, and just education in general. And then the technologies and talents that are in the game industry really have shown to have proven capabilities beyond games, and we can exploit this. And we can exploit the cast off of an industry that has, you know, global revenues in excess of $20 billion. I sometimes liken the serious game space as to a privately funded NASA in terms of how NASA has sometimes justified its existence to us as citizens in terms of not just shooting somebody to the moon or Mars or a satellite into space, but a number of different Earth-based technologies and achievements that we've gained. So in terms of why games, well, good games on slide 20, it's a very text-filled slide, but I think that good games actually offer ways that link into the way the brain actually processes and stores information, mainly because it abstracts and tries to make information more palatable in terms of pattern matching and the types of things our brain really likes to do with it from a sensory input standpoint. And games are obviously very highly motivating when they're done right. They can instill time on task. They can also help us achieve a sort of flow state that's been talked about by a number of different educational researchers. We can look at emotional aspects to how we tie that into learning. We can do some carrot and stick things. We can offer some mastery. We can offer some challenging opportunities, and we can adjust pacing in terms of learning. And I think that games offer us a thought space, a way to sort of view and interact with information in an augmented fashion that we might not have done before. And maybe we do it with modeling and simulation, but I often try to describe gaming as a democratization of modeling and simulation, taking those ideas from modeling and simulation, wrapping it in a better interface, culling what might not necessarily be so tragically important in terms of a five decimal point process, and giving us as teachers and students tools so that we can experiment with this kind of thinking and style of learning. And we can abstract things with games so that we can understand them as systems versus the disparate parts. Games tend to be abstracted, metaphorical, and representational more than exacting. They can be exacting, but we tend to do great work when we strip out sorts of things and we try to get to the general representations in a system, and games tend to do that really well, and game designers tend to be very good at looking at systems and distilling that in such a way where we can boil it down to its core components, teach somebody some of those interrelationships, and give them a nucleus upon which we can then, through other means, layer on those more complexities, fix some of the inaccuracies if we feel we need to, and move people forward with a very rich understanding. And games also instill people to augment them. There's lots of player communities. There's lots of discussion that games tend to create. And these are all types of rich opportunities for learning. I'll wrap up in terms of trying to talk about this by saying that the lessons thus far are that games apply resources to a broad array of problems in creative ways, that serious games don't always result in games just to have an impact, that games also have some great media-specific positives that we're just starting to understand, and that our case is driven somewhat primarily by the demographic trends of people using computers, being exposed to gaming, being exposed to simulation and modeling, things that we readily accept in education, but through gaming, and that we're starting to see some emerging supportive research and ever more capable hardware. In terms of learning, very specifically, there is a lot of noise out there about games. But let me talk about a few points. I think that there's an important aspect to elasticity when it comes to gaming, meaning that the game will be, if the game isn't so good that it would immediately draw somebody in, well, that's okay if what the person is motivated by is the subject matter. If I'm a doctor and I give somebody a decent but not, you know, ultimately great commercial game, they're still motivated. They're like, hey, this is my world that they're talking about. And we can use these types of elasticities, a teacher present as part of the facilitation, peer-to-peer learning, other types of tools that have been around education for a while to wrap around the game. So we don't necessarily always have to be creating the next, you know, halo to somehow pull people's attention over to what we're talking about. We can give them great tools. They don't have to be the state of the art. Another thing is interface, is to look at gaming as a culture of interface. A very honed culture of how we present information to people in very, very new and exciting and multimodal ways that have not been experimented as much in other styles of software, both application and learning-based. There's also a sense of complexity. I think that games offer us an opportunity in e-learning to tackle more complex subjects, such as, you know, not just what was Rome, but let's give you a virtual version of Rome that really goes into the complexities of the Roman economy, of how the warfare worked then, of the interaction between the expanding empire and the politics back in Rome. All of that could be more richly discussed in gaming. I think it's also important to say that a lot of serious game stuff that's been done and a lot of things that will be done tend to be things where I think the interest was in creating a curriculum around things that aren't typically on a syllabus. I mean, a lot of the work that I've done has been on teaching various science subjects that when they said, well, you know, will this conform to the standards in schools? I'm like, well, heck, we're not even teaching this stuff on the syllabus. We're not teaching how packet-based communications work in seventh grade. But I can give a game that does teach that to students. And as far as I'm concerned as a parent, I'd love it if my kid came home and knew how the internet worked. But we don't have these things on our syllabus. So we're looking at games, and in some cases, I think a lot of people, both the creators and funders, are looking at games to bring in new subject matter into the curriculum. And we're still debating what the acceptable measurements might be in learning with games. And I'll talk in a second before I wrap up on that. There is some research out there, and there are also some papers worth reading. FAS, the Federation of American Scientists, I have a link there to a paper that they did that talks about what they think the infrastructure needs to be to expand this. There's my original white paper that was put out by the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, where we talk mostly about using them for policy initiatives, training, and teaching about policy. But it gets into discussion about what might be the comparative development advantages of games. Future Lab, a group in the UK, has done some really great on-the-ground looks at what games do when they go into classrooms and what the problems are in getting them to work. I also want to highlight a specific paper I just recently came across called Null Magic Bullet 3D Video Games in Education, about a project that Georgia Tech did called Aquamoose, where they had not great results. But when you read why, when you read that the perception that the students had when they were told this is a game and they didn't set any other expectations, and how that created a fault line that just they drowned under, I think it's a very, very useful early paper that really shows us what the challenges, what the promise might be, but what the challenges are. It's a little bit of a reality check that I really enjoy. In terms of learning, at the recent Serious Games Summit, and this is a paper that Carnegie Mellon and my company and Bill Crosby are working on, we found over 100 citations of off-the-shelf commercial games that you would buy for your kids for entertainment that are being used in serious game settings, two-thirds of which, by my estimation, were learning. Teachers using games like Civilization to teach history. Teachers using games to teach various properties of physics and other types of things. And this is really interesting grassroots, from the ground up, appropriation of games, and we can learn a lot from that, both the good and the bad side. A lot of informal versus formal learning. Most of the work is in the informal space. Lower hanging versus deeper. What I mean by that is I think we're still trying to figure out where the lower hanging uses of this are, even though we're really certainly interested in the deeper applications. It's going to take a lot more time to get to that. But I'd hate to see us skip over the lower hanging opportunities just because we're searching for that magic bullet. There are a lot of need for more studies. I'm enthused by some of the work that Jan Cannon-Bowers at UCF is doing. She has a long background in cognitive science, teamwork, and learning transfer in adult training situations. DIGRA, the Digital Games Research Association, is a great source. The MacArthur Foundation is doing $50 million of grants in digital learning, of which a significant appropriation is going to gaming. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, while looking at health, is also looking at learning issues related to health. And the Department of Defense is doing quite a bit. And as researchers, there's lots of SBIR grants coming out through DoD trying to hone at some of these bigger media and game design issues as they relate to learning. There's also the Hidden Agenda competition at hiddenagenda.com. But overall, I would just like to highlight we're really struggling with last mile issues, not just creating things, not just figuring out if they work, but what can we do to make them work in classrooms better. So we've come a long way in a few years. Hopefully I haven't taken too much time. The research agenda is still being set, but and is barely being met, but the momentum to get it right is building really nicely this year. We can't just research. We need to build, but we can't just research and build. We have to do both of them together equally. And we can have an effect, but the strength side and pervasiveness of what games might be in classrooms are open questions. We have to define how this stuff gets used, how it integrates into classrooms, what the do's and don'ts are. And then also, let me leave this last point. It's interesting to me that what we're trying to figure out with games, we're trying to use measures that we've applied to other styles of learning. Yet, when we think about the things that just pass the smell test with gaming, teaching strategy, teaching creative thinking, We have hard ways to measure those things. So in many ways, we're victims in gaming of not being able to measure very effectively the things that we know in our hearts we do better than probably a lot of other things. So one of my big calls for, and I'm actually talking to a number of people, is trying to figure out ways that we could even get empirical results to see how we're affecting people's strategic thinking, problem-solving skills in general, and creativity. And whether or not we can draw some of that out, because I think the before and after effects with gaming would be measurable there. And that would help justify some of this before we even got to some of the other things that we're trying to apply gaming towards. So I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you just stand by, what I'd like to do is, if at all possible, we could bring up Gail and have her presentation. And if you stand by, if there are any questions for Ben afterwards, you can come forward and he can address them at that time. Would that be okay, Ben?
Sure. I'll be here for a bit.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Dr. Stein, do you want to try a combo check here? Robert? No audio, Robert. While we're working on that, are there any questions for Ben Sawyer? Question over here?
One of the things that always gets me frustrated when I want to think about developing a game is that I may even be able to think of ways to assess it, I may be able to come up with scenarios, but my understanding is that there is software that has to support it underneath, and it's called gaming engines, and that's where the huge expense comes in. I could be wrong, but are there groups that have gaming engines that don't cost, you know, the equivalent of a new Mercedes that could be used in educational settings?
Game development could cost $500 to $50 million. There are game engines like Torque that cost, you know, free or $100. Panda, a great 3D engine maintained by Carnegie Mellon, is free and open source. We've done projects at our firm for as low as $6,000 for teaching, you know, principles of fiber optics or principles of. We've done higher end stuff for teaching chemistry and other things. I mean, a game engine is a particular process by which you might build a game, especially for 3D graphics and stuff. But you can just open up any kind of development environment and build a game. A game could just be a series of great text adventures. I mean, there's a wide variety of what we can define as and what can fit expectations and fulfillment as games. I think that the general question that you have are two things. One is you're struggling with just how to build a game, so that's where I think you have to bring in the experience, be it outside the university or within, with students in computer science programs or game development programs that are starting up on campuses around the globe, or bring in, you know, firms or local area game developers who can help with that. I've seen a number of great projects done in the low tens of thousands of dollars or even less. I've seen great stuff just done by students as part of credit work. It's part of being creative as the designer. We actually did at the last Serious Games Summit, I did a two-hour tutorial on low-cost game development for Serious Games in terms of trying to help people think through these issues, because I know it is one. But you really have to dig into it. There are ways to do that. And I'm sure Bill, if he's there, can be a resource to getting tapped into some of those areas.
Any questions in Camden or Newark if we have communications? Yes, a question here. No? Question over here.
We do have a question in Camden as well.
Okay. Camden, go ahead with your question.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, do you consider Second Life a game, or is that a different sort of animal?
Sure. Yeah, great question. So I'm good friends with all of them there. Two things. The game space and the virtual world space are sort of colliding. You wouldn't, depending on the definitions that we use in game design, Second Life would not be a game itself, but it can enable games. But in terms of the serious game space, most of the people who built Second Life at the technology level were game developers. That's why they went and got them, because they needed those skills. And there are other virtual worlds. Sure, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. One of my questions is, I'm a librarian, and as librarians, we have to teach skill sets. Okay, mm-hmm. And a lot of libraries and a lot of library schools are starting to use Second Life and sort of been investigating that. It looks like there's been some elaborate projects within Second Life, but it's sort of the reverse of if you build it, they will come. It's like they build it, and then nobody shows up at these places.
Right.
They're
well,
like abandoned. So is there a recipe? Because I guess people are drawn to that because it's sort of free. You know, like it's already, the infrastructure is there to create this sort of game-like experience.
Sure.
But is
well,
there
a couple of
recipe for creating
well,
a good one?
Second Life has sort of gone beyond its audience in terms of its hype, and they're the first to admit it. They do have an audience. It is growing. The tool set's what's so compelling to initially. But the overall issue that I alluded to in my talk is that even though we're building even exciting games or exciting network environments in terms of virtual worlds like Second Life, there is a lot of work that has to go into pulling audience into these things. And if I'm a grant provider and I advise grant providers, I'm always looking to say there has to be a marketing plan, there has to be some semblance of how they're going to draw people into this. I think in terms of Second Life specifically, the company is going to have to do more. They're going to help their developers do more. But it may just be early for that sort of stuff, and there may be new types of virtual worlds that come about that do bring an immense amount of audiences that make that easier. Habbo Hotel is not a Second Life in terms of capability, but in terms of online virtual world where you can do experiment with sort of social aspects and learning aspects and communication aspects in virtual world, they have an audience that's in the millions, tens of millions. So there, and Wyville is another product that goes through K through, looks at sort of younger middle school kids as their key audience, and they have done a fantastic job with a much lower end environment creating community and getting volumes through to their applications. So it's a hard part of all of this.